Welcome to another bonus episode of Scepter Publishers Podcast. Today we're talking with new author Angela Fortunato about her book, Wholeheartedly, God's Mystery of Love and the Call to Celibacy. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you so much, Katie. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us just a little bit about the book itself, Wholeheartedly, and then kind of what inspires you to write it?
Okay, so Wholeheartedly is about celibacy, as you said, apostolic celibacy in the middle of the world, which is my vocation as a numerary member of Opus Dei. So it's a very personal book, I would say. It's a personal journey, a personal reflection, personal stories are in it. It's not a theoretical academic text.
Sure.
At the same time, I tried to draw on books and articles that I've read, conversations that I've had that get into more of the why and the how and the reason behind celibacy in the church in general. So I've drawn on authors such as Pope John Paul II and his Theology of the Body. I would say his inspiration is largely one motivation for the book and background. I've also drawn on some more contemporary authors, some of whom have only written their texts in Spanish or Italian or other languages. So another motivation for my book was to get something written about apostolic celibacy in English that was approachable to an English reader audience. And then I definitely was motivated by a desire to share a woman's story and reflection on this, because from what I've read, all of the things, all of the sources that I've read on celibacy really are written by men, mostly by priests. So
sure.
I felt like a needed niche in this, within these sources of information, would be a woman's approach, because, you know, I think it's actually probably more than half of the celibate members of the church are women. So we have a story to tell and insights of a woman's experience living that vocation.
Absolutely. And what do you think, or how do you feel this book fits kind of into where we are right now in culture, in the church, in the world today?
So other authors have focused on, and other social scientists, I think, have pointed out the fact that we have a cultural situation where fewer people are getting married, fewer people are having children, having large families, or fewer people are having those large families. And so in that cultural context, it makes sense. It's not surprising that we're also have seen a decrease in vocations to celibacy in the church, whether that be religious vocations, priestly vocations, or in my case, numerary and celibate vocations in Opus Dei, numeraries and associates primarily. And I think that this book is kind of a call for especially those practicing Catholics, serious Christians who want to see marriage protected, but also marriage promoted, for them to understand that celibacy is actually a big support and a huge part of that support and protection of marriage. And if we really care about marriage in the middle of the world, then we should care a lot about celibacy. And if we really care about the culture being one which promotes family, and then we should be caring a lot about celibacy.
Okay. So for those who are like sitting here listening to this and thinking like, but wait, celibate people don't have families, they don't get married, like how does living celibacy in the world help families, help marriages? What's your kind of answer to that?
Well, I think my answer that I give in the book is largely experiential, right? That it's in my experience, actually, my life has been all about supporting marriages, specific, you know, particular marriages, but also I like to say I gave up my own marriage in order to help many, 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 many marriages and marriage itself. So I think those of us who care again about family and marriage should care about celibacy. I think it's also important to clarify that in my life as a member of Opus Dei, I do live a family life. I do live in a family, since Opus Dei is a spiritual family. That is a very real style of family life. And then I also came from a family, which comes up a bit in the book, that it's those of us who, you know, came from happy family life that I think are in the best kind of situation to welcome a vocation that comes from God to celibacy. And maybe I should actually comment of my overall motivation that I think about for the book too is that I want to get this message out there because I love God's will. I think that's kind of the ultimate reason, and I love and I want God's beneficent will, his goodwill for the world right now with our culture the way it is. I want his beneficent will for our nation and for our church, and I think and I trust that he's calling many people, many young people to a variety of vocations in the church. And I want this generation of young people to be really, really, really happy. I want them to therefore respond to whatever it is that wholeheartedly respond to whatever it is that God might be asking of them, and for them to be really happy for eternity. But eternity starts here on earth. It's so we want to be happy here in our lives.
Great. And for those who are new to this kind of term, apostolic celibacy, do you want to define that just a little bit for people who are unfamiliar?
Sure. Apostolic celibacy, I would say, focuses a bit on the first term, apostolic. It's a way of being a follower of Jesus Christ, an apostle of Jesus Christ, that it's a very fulfilling way of living, where we would share the life and love of Jesus Christ with those around us. That's how I think of the term apostolic. And then being apostolically celibate means to, in one sense, you could say, to not get married for the needs of the church, but for precisely in a way that is even more sharing the life and love of Jesus Christ with those around us because of my dedication in the church, to the people of the church, but also to God himself. There's a commitment and a response to God's call. It's the gift of celibacy is really what comes from God, an offer of himself that to a person, that the person in for me, that I responded positively to God, that I said yes to his offer of that unmediated mutual gift of self. So I responded to God's love for me by saying yes and responding by, giving myself completely to him, rather than through a husband and marriage.
Great. What, as you wrote the book and now as you're like done and it's going to print, it'll be out in February as they listen to this podcast. What do you hope readers take away from the book? Like, what's the main message that you want to make sure that they like walk away with?
I think the main message that I hope that all the readers walk away with is that I love my vocation, that and that it's very fulfilling. And each path is very unique. I think, I'm not the same person as each other numerary member of Opus Dei, but that in general, these vocations to celibacy in Opus Dei, or in general, the vocations to celibacy in the church, in our world, are very, very much a gift from God and very much a path to happiness here on earth and for eternity, and benefit a lot of other people in the church.
Excellent. I love that. What about the misconceptions about celibacy? Do you cover those in the book? And like, what are some of those that you kind of trying to dispel?
Katie, thank you so much for asking that question. So actually, that's really another motivation for my book. Over the years, so I've been following this vocation for really for 30 years. I wrote the book as a kind of a Thanksgiving of my 30th anniversary since God called me when I was just a teenager. So it's all over these years, I've heard quite a few misconceptions voiced, including by priests, including by other members of Opus Dei, including by very happily married people, a mix of in almost every case, committed Christians. So it's not to put down their understanding, it's just to clarify those misconceptions. So I have 9 chapters in the book, and each one actually, in my mind, refers to a misconception. So, but I don't kind of call out the misconceptions in the book. The book is more of a positive exposition, I would say. But as I'm going around to give my talk about the book, I actually am in those book talks discussing with people those misconceptions and seeing are these misconceptions that so that people could, especially married couples, could maybe go home and consider, oh, do we, do I have this misconception? What would we do if one of our children came to us and said, maybe I think God might be calling me to the priesthood, or God might be calling me to a celibate path in the church. How would we approach that? How would we react? I know my parents reacted with a lot of gratitude. They said congratulations. They saw that as a very positive thing, but they also saw that they needed to pray for me a lot more, that I would need a lot of support to persevere. And then, so in these book talks, we're going through the misconceptions, and then I'm going to open the floor to the audience of are sharing with me any other misconceptions or any other ideas or questions they might have, because a big part of the motivation for the book is helping people to answer the questions that they have about celibacy for themselves, but also for their loved ones, for anybody. I think if we have that increasing mutual respect between marriage and celibacy, we can see them actually as part of the same thing. They're very much both Christian marriage and apostolic celibacy, both part of the same Christian life of chastity that our Lord challenges us to. And that ultimately is a challenge to live his life, right, with him, to identify ourselves with Christ, which is ultimately the goal, no matter what our path is. So I'm hoping that this book and these talks can address misconceptions and help people have more conversations.
Sure, absolutely. Can you peel back the curtain a little and share one misconception? Maybe the one that is your biggest pet peeve or the one you hear the most?
Yeah, I think, well, I'm going back to the idea of there being so few books, or really no books that I've come across written by women. A couple of the misconceptions that are my pet peeves have to do more with women and celibacy. So I definitely have heard, especially men, say that they would assume that celibacy is easier for women than for men, because women don't care about sex as much, and that if a woman is very career driven in our current culture, where there's a dearth of good men, where there is a high percentage of adult men living in their mother's basements playing video games, that maybe celibacy would be easy right now for women. There's not a lot of men. I can do my profession, so I'll just be celibate. And I think that does not give credit, I guess, to how hard of a response this is, and the fact that it is a vocation, right? We don't just, it's not just someone's choice. Like, okay, I'm going to opt to this, and I'm going to pick the least of bad choices. No, that's not what celibacy is about as a vocation. It's a call from God, which means he's going to give all the grace to meet those challenges, but it's hard.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay, that's a good one. I think especially, yeah, thinking of women, and I'm sure so many people I know, I mean, even I'm sure we all know so many like young single women who are struggling to find someone, and anyway, but it's not just like, oh, it's an extra choice, like whatever. Good.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit, kind of in the book, you talk about how the vocation to apostolic celibacy kind of uniquely positions an individual to be in the world, like in the midst of the world, but not like of the world, like kind of still set apart. So, like, what does that look like? What is that role that they play?
Another great question. Thanks, Katie. So I would say in our another aspect of our culture right now is that it's such a consumerist and materialistic culture where we're easily focused on things, on tasks, right? And as Christians, and particularly as Catholics, I know Pope Francis is always reminding us to focus on people, right? To be concerned for the poor, to look at how we're being generous with others. And the vocation to celibacy comes with many graces, along with the grace of the vocation itself. And some of those graces are precisely kind of antidotes to some of these cultural ills for ourselves, for sure, for our own souls, being antidotes to those cultural ills of consumerism and materialism and hedonism, but for others too, as a witness to others, an example to others, because with that call to celibacy comes these graces that we have to actualize, but to live real poverty, to live real detachment from material things, to live a detachment from what other people think of us, to live a certain availability, even to move for a greater need than just our own professional need or our own wants, to be available to people, to be interruptible. Those graces, which I mean, I think it's no surprise, none of us respond to perfectly, right? We're all works in progress with all of those many graces for many virtues. But those living a celibate vocation at least are trying actively to live those virtues and respond to those graces. And that gives a great witness to everyone in society. And we need that, right? We need that countercultural Christian witness to the spirit of poverty, detachment, chastity, all these great virtues that are so needed today.
Excellent. When I looked at all the chapter titles, chapter four was the chapter title I was most intrigued by. It's called Being Comfortable with Insecurity and Uncertainty. Tell me a little bit about that chapter.
Okay, great. So this very much along the lines of what we were just discussing with poverty and availability, these tough virtues, I think. And insecurity is not necessarily virtue, and but what it's getting or what the chapter is about, I think, does point to those virtues of putting our security firmly in God. It's a divine security rather than a security in earthly goods.
Sure.
So that chapter is largely draws on commentary by Pope Benedict XVI about celibacy and this idea of the Jubilee. Actually, we're celebrating a Jubilee year this year, right? The idea of a time where the Jews would not have I know, would not have as much security in their land and in their things. So that's a parallel or a symbol maybe of celibacy, where we don't have the security of that comes with having children and having our name pass on, and the security of knowing I don't know where our bank account is, all of our kind of material and financial goods, that we've actually kind of abandoned a lot of that into the hands of God for, again, for greater needs of the church and of souls. So that chapter tries to get at some of these virtues, these Christian virtues that are hard to even figure out. I think living in the middle of the world, it's hard to figure out how am I supposed to, like, how does God want me to live poverty? How am I supposed to be living detachment? It's not that clear when actually we do have stuff, right? And I do need stuff. Well, I've tried in my life to figure out, okay, how do I still have the stuff I need, but not fall into the traps of being attached to that those things? And so I quote Saint Jose Maria in that chapter, as I do often in the book, and he gives several pieces of advice that are extremely practical, I think, and very much the answer to all this, like having only what you need, not complaining when you're lacking things, taking the worst when there's an option. These are great to really consistently live by that advice is to live with and be comfortable with insecurity and detachment.
Absolutely. Curious if you have a favorite chapter of all the ones that you wrote and why.
That is a great question. Do I have a favorite chapter? Maybe, maybe the preface, actually, which is kind of funny. I wrote that first, and it's where I remember as I was writing it, I think where I've used my memory the most in a to remember my mom, who
Mm-hmm.
died when I was 22. So she's mentioned in the book when I was still in college. She passed away, and so those memories of being with my mom, that's in there, and some memories with Pope John Paul II are in there. So I think that kind of looking back and just being grateful with my life that came up in the preface and even the dedication. I dedicated the book to my sister, who's this year, well, this past year, celebrated her 30th wedding anniversary. And then all my brothers and sisters in Opus Dei who have lived, sometimes we don't always think of our lives as being such a help to other people, but I can say, so true that everyone I've ever met has helped me in my path. So I wanted to give thanks and gratitude to them and kind of a tribute, because I think people don't always, I mean, because they if I'm right that people don't always understand celibacy, that means they undervalue the
Sure.
people who live that out that vocation. So I wanted kind of give a tribute to them.
Absolutely. Okay, Angela, as we wrap up, anything we didn't cover or anything you want to say last minute for anybody who's listening to this?
I think I would just say that I really did not intend to write a book at
Great.
first. A year ago, I had no intention to write a book. And I gave a series of talks to women, to married women. And one of those women, Dia Boyle, who's also one of your Scepter authors, convinced me to turn it into my talk into a book. And then it was easier than I thought. So to and Scepter was great to work with. So I just have had a lot of fun. And now I consider everything having to do with this book as my hobby. So I'm just having a lot of fun with it. So thanks so much.
Oh, that's great. I love that. So the book is available now on Scepter's website. You can grab it anytime. It's called Wholeheartedly: God's Mystery of Love in the Call to Celibacy. Thanks, Angela, for sharing your insights and a little bit of the background behind your book.
Thanks, Katie.